still working on those first two chapters of Hassel. I believe in the last class hour, that handout I had given you last week, we were up to question 4, which is the bottom of page 13 of that handout. And the question is, what are the characteristics of the 9 distinguishable major methods for doing Old Testament theology, which Hassel enumerates? What Hassel, of course, has tried to do is to classify all these different attempts to write an Old Testament theology according to some principle of classification, which is his own principle. You look at all these books and see what certain ones of them have in common, what their organizing principle is, and try to group them in classes. As he says, and this is top page 14, the divisions are not mutually exclusive. Authors are placed in the category to which they have made a contribution or by the characteristic which is most typical of their work. It's not as easy to classify some of these works as you might think, just to put them into these 9 different categories. But, on the other hand, I think doing that is of some help in trying to get an idea of how different people have gone about trying to write an Old Testament theology. So the 9 are listed there: dogmatic didactic method, genetic progressive method, topical method, diachronic method, formation of tradition method, thematic dialectical method, the new biblical theology method, and multiplex canonical Old Testament theology. Before discussing the 9 major methods, Hassel speaks about the descriptive and or normative tasks. And that is, I think, an important section of this chapter, which begins on page 35. Hayes, in this volume I mentioned last week, Old Testament Theology, Its History and Development, also discusses this issue on page 208 and following. So first, some comments about that. J.P. Gabler, in his inaugural address, 1782, formalized the descriptive approach. Today, it is represented in Christer Stendahl's article on biblical theology in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. Go back to your bibliography and look under biblical theology. That's page 2 of the bibliography. Toward the bottom of the page, you notice Christer Stendahl, Biblical Theology Contemporary in the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. That's considered a pretty standard treatment of biblical theology. Christer Stendahl was of Harvard Divinity School, and that's an influential article. Stendahl really represents the approach of Gabler in contemporary form. So today it's represented in Christer Stendahl's article on Biblical Theology, Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible. In this approach, a strictly historical descriptive method is used to answer the question what the text meant. This is kept quite apart and distinct from the question what the text means. That is, for one reading the text today. As Stendahl puts it, page 422 of that article, the paragraph heading, is a New Testament theology possible? Quote, many are those who express serious doubts about the possibility of the descriptive task as pictured above. Every historian is subjective in the selection of his material, and it is often said that he does more harm when he thinks himself to be objective, that is, when he does not recognize, not to say openly state, what his presuppositions and preconceived ideas are. All of this naturally calls for caution. But the relativity of human objectivity does not give us an excuse to excel in bias, not even when we state our bias in an introductory chapter. What is more important, however, is that once we confine ourselves to the task of a descriptive biblical theology as a field in its own right, the material itself gives us the means to check whether our interpretation is correct or not. To be sure, the sources are not extensive enough to allow us certainty in all areas, and the right to use some comparative material while disregarding other such material as irrelevant for our text gives further reason for uncertainty. But from the point of view of method, it is clear that our only concern is to find out what these words meant when uttered or written by the prophet, the priest, the evangelist, or the apostle. And regardless of their meaning in later stages of religious history, our own included. Such a program is, by and large, a new feature in biblical studies, a mature fruit of the, notice, historical method. This descriptive task, as continues from Stendhal, can be carried out by believer and agnostic alike. The believer has the advantage of automatic empathy with the believers in the text, but his faith constantly threatens to have him modernize the material if he does not exercise the canons of descriptive scholarship rigorously. The agnostic has the advantage of feeling no such temptations, but his power of empathy must be considerable if he is to identify himself sufficiently with the believer of the first century. Yet both can work side by side, since no other tools are called for than those of description in the terms indicated by the texts themselves. The meaning for the present, in which the two interpreters are different, is not involved. And thus, total cooperation is possible, and part of their mutual criticism is to watch whether concern for meaning or distaste for meaning colors the descriptions where it should not. Stendhal, under the heading The Descriptive Approach in the Old Testament, also page 422, I think that's the same page, regards this descriptive task, which elucidates what the text meant, as far more difficult and complex with the Old Testament text. The reasons for this, in his view, are basically two. One, the Old Testament contains material from many centuries of Israelite life. This makes it obvious that there are different layers of meaning within the same account. The account of the sacrifice of Isaac may well once have functioned as God's own command of substituting an animal for human sacrifices, but in its present setting, in Genesis 22, the meaning is clearly seen as a witness to Abraham's ultimate obedience. Thus, the descriptive task is faced with the constant question of layers of meaning through the history and transmission of Old Testament traditions. The history of interpretation is woven into the very fabric of the biblical texts themselves, and the canonization of Torah, prophets, and writings did not disrupt the ongoing reinterpretation in sectarian or normative Judaism, as we learn from the intertestamental and the rabbinic material. Thus, any statement of a descriptive sort about what an Old Testament passage meant has to be accompanied by an address for whom and at what stage of Israelite or Jewish history. Now, you see, the assumption behind that is the whole historical critical methodology of analyzing biblical literature. It would say that this literature has gone through a long history. And what he's saying is you have to take all that into account. And you can't just ask what the question, what it means. You have to ask what it means at any given point in that process of development or transmission. So that there could be many different meanings at different points, you see, in the history of that. Which, admittedly, as he says, makes that question much more complicated. If you're going to assume his methodology and utilize it, it makes it much more complicated than the Old Testament. Second thing, why it's more difficult. Page 423. The church was born out of a dispute with Jewish interpreters of the Old Testament regarding its meaning. The Christian claim to the Old Testament rested on the conviction that Jesus, as the risen Christ, was the Messiah to whom the Old Testament witnessed. The church thereby sided with those interpreters of the Old Testament who, like, for example, the Qumran community, saw the center of the Old Testament and its prophecies and promises, including those found in the five books of the law, While the Jewish exegesis, which became normative more and more, emphasized the law as the core of revelation and the precious token of Israel's chosen status. Any writer in the field of Old Testament theology must be aware of this double outcome of the ongoing interpretation of the Old Testament material, each within the framework of a community of faith. That expression, community of faith, is quite common to Stendhal and others of his approach. For the descriptive task, both outcomes appear as live options. And neither of them can claim to be the right one if judged by the potentialities of the Old Testament material itself. Now, see, that's a rather important statement. What he's saying is that on the basis of the potentiality of the Old Testament material, it's legitimate to have gone either in the direction that the Jewish people went or in the direction that the writers of the New Testament went. The act of faith, notice that act of faith, by which the interpretations parted ways, does not add anything to the Old Testament material as such. Thus, the Christian and Jewish Old Testament theology differ only where the question of meaning is pursued beyond the material and the period of the Old Testament texts themselves. Now, in brackets, I just put a comment in there, but what are the teaching of Christ? Luke 24, 25 to 27, John 5, 45 to 47. Luke 24 says, he said to them, "How foolish you are, how slow of heart to believe all that the prophets have spoken. Did not the Christ have to suffer these things and then enter his glory? Beginning with Moses and all the prophets, he explained to them what was said in all the scriptures concerning himself." In John 5, 45, you have a similar statement. "But do not think I will accuse you before the Father. Your accuser is Moses, on whom your hopes are set. If you believed Moses, you would have believed me, for he wrote about me. But since you do not believe what he wrote, how are you going to believe what I say?" Notice Stendhal's next statement. "Such a Christian Old Testament theology may find its organizing principle in the New Testament understanding of the Old Testament in first century terms. Nobody would deny the validity of even the necessity for the church of such a task, especially since it is the very tradition of the New Testament itself." But you see, what he speaks of there is a Christian Old Testament theology may find its organizing principle in the New Testament understanding of the Old Testament. But you see, what he's suggesting is there are other valid understandings of the Old Testament besides the New Testament understanding of the Old Testament. And would we say then that the New Testament understanding is only one of other possible valid understandings of the Old Testament? I don't think that's what Jesus is saying. When you go back to those texts, Jesus is saying, if you had understood and believed the Old Testament, you would understand and believe me because it spoke of me. In any case, this is Stendhal's line of argumentation. He says, when the Old Testament is treated in this fashion, as living and growing tradition of a people, it yields a theology which brings us up to the parting of the ways by Jews and Christians. The description thereof places us where the New Testament stands. And we face the issues of New Testament theology as once Jews and Christians faced them in the first century. The only question which is beyond reach for such a descriptive approach is, who was right, the Jews or the Christians? Notice the next statement. Its answer remains what it always was, an act of faith. I put in brackets, Stendhal seems here to view faith as subjective and arbitrary rather than a response to revelation. Faith is belief rather than that which rests in the sufficiency of the evidence. See, what he seems to be saying is there are equally valid options, and it's just a matter of your choice versus mine. What one person wants to believe versus what somebody else wants to believe. If you go to the Old Testament material itself, it allows either option. The crucial question arises when we ask, this is Stendhal, continuing. Crucial question arises when we ask what impact the New Testament should have on the presentation of Old Testament theology. When biblical theology allows for such impact, it goes beyond its descriptive task. Unless what is being attempted is merely a description of how the early church understood the unity between the Old Testament and its fulfillment and what came to be the New Testament. But if the biblical theologian should go on to say that this is consequently what the Old Testament text meant, he would be making either a statement of his own faith or a statement about the faith of the New Testament. If he says that this is what the Old Testament means for the present-day Christian, he has proceeded from description via hermeneutics to contemporary interpretation. Thus, the treatment, top page 17, of the Bible as a unity in this sense is beyond the task of descriptive biblical theology. Bracket, my own comment. Is it really biblical theology then? Or the history of religion of Israel? Is such an objective, non-committed, descriptive approach possible? Are you really doing justice to the material if you use his method? I don't think so. As Hassell notes, B.S. Childs objects to this, quote, descriptive method is too limiting. He argues, this is from Hassell 38-39, quoting Childs, when seen from the context of the canon, both the question of what the text meant and what it means are inseparably linked, and both belong to the task of the interpretation of the Bible as Scripture. Of course, that puts you into this context of Child's so-called canonical approach. But I think at that point, without getting into his whole methodology, I think what he says there is right. We must look at the Bible as a unity, not just as two separate parts that have no relation to each other. And this text of what it meant and what it means shouldn't be broken apart in the way in which Stendhal does, going back to Gabriel. And of course, you see what's at stake here and what it meant. You're going to use the historical critical method in order to establish what it meant. And that is supposed to be objective and scientific. But there again, the whole historical critical method is involved with a lot of assumptions that are invalid assumptions to start with. So, but that's going back to Gabler and coming up to the present through Stendhal. That is the way in which a lot of people have looked at this this question of biblical theology. Yes.
How is the person of this intelligence maintain such a hard dichotomy between the Old and New Testament? So what it seems to be doing, they're entirely separate traditions and so forth. And it's just not the case. They're so inherently interwoven.
Well, I imagine he, I don't know, I would agree with that, but he would argue from the side of Jewish interpretation, which hasn't accepted the New Testament as a sequel, so to speak, and say that the Jewish position is a valid position on the basis of the content of the material itself. And it's just simply a matter of faith if you're going to go and link the New Testament with it. Now, the way he is using faith there, I think, is part of the problem. Because it seems to me the way he's using faith is to suggest that it has no rational grounds or no factual basis, which I think could be contested.
So you said the Jewish element on the Jewish Christian. wrote the New Testament.
No, what I mean is he looks at the Jewish community that has not accepted the New Testament. The Jewish community that goes back to the first century, where you get into this dispute, how's the best way to understand and read the Old Testament? Is it in light of rabbinic teaching or in light of the teaching of Christ? So there's a parting of ways there, equally legitimate. And the only reason for the difference is this question of faith, what you want to believe. And certainly the Old Testament itself allows for going either direction.
When he talks about the reinterpretation of what it means, and you read each period as a specific reinterpretation, that's reinterpretation of Revelation, what he's talking about, right?
Well, the Old Testament, in our view, would be in Revelation.
Yeah. From a liberal approach, they can reinterpret anything that they want to in a non-humanistic fashion. Right?
Yeah.
See,
that reinterpretation, though, involves the theological sense or meaning which belongs to the faith community of a particular group in a particular time that is construing it in that particular way. And there can be many legitimate such groups and such meanings. And that is not scientific. That's, you see, in this other category of belief. So that almost anything goes there. When you talk about what it meant, you're back in this objective scientific discipline where everybody, at least theoretically, should be able to agree what it meant.
So he's blending like an existential approach to what it means, and there's all this.
But you see, that's this question, descriptive and or normative test. What is normative is what a given faith community will say is normative for itself. It's what it believes. That's what it means. Whereas what it meant is this descriptive text that's objective and scientific.
So that would give a license for a future generation to reinterpret this generation as determined to be normative.
Yes. And you see, that idea is at the heart of a lot of modern theology. It's at the heart of, you go to the Presbyterian Church, this so-called Book of Confessions. You know, it used to be that the Westminster Confession was the standard confession of the Presbyterian Church. And in the 1960s, they wanted to change that. And rather than just throw it out, they adopted a Book of Confession. They went back and they said, well, the Apostles' Creed's a good confession, the Nicene Creed's a good confession, the Chalcedonian Creed's a good confession, and the Helvetic Confession's a good confession, and the Canons of Dort are a good confession, and Westminster's a good confession, and now we're going to add another one to it. All these things are true for the community of belief at the time in which they wrote them and believed them, but since there is nothing that's really ever absolute about this, you can just keep evolving more and more of these things, and they're all true for their own time and place, but only for their own time and place. In other words, the Westminster Confession is not necessarily true for us today. Which is the same kind of principle as this, applied to a different area. About who? Childs? What page do you have in mind? Or statement you have in mind? I think he has serious questions about this descriptive task being separate. In other words, separating
what it meant from what it means. I also have serious questions about that. He doesn't think that can be legitimately done in these neat categories like Stendhal does. For example, you see on page 37, he says, at the top of page 37, the distinction between what a text meant and what a text means is at the core of the most fundamental problem of Old Testament theology, because what it meant is not simply discovering the meaning of the biblical text within its own canonical biblical context, it is historical reconstruction. See, that whole higher historical critical method lies behind the attempt to establish what a text meant. And Hassell finds a problem with that. Historical reconstruction, see further down, or what the text meant, understands the Bible is conditioned by its time and by its surroundings. Just what it meant is historical reconstruction done with the principles of the historical critical method. So what it means is theological interpretation. Theological interpretation is the translation of the historically reconstructed text into the situation of the modern world. Normally this means that the key to theological interpretation is the modern world view of the individual interpreter. Well, you see, Hassell takes strong issue with the historical critical method.
He's separating it,
but he's just describing what is done by someone like either Gabler or Stendhal or others. And here he is just trying to explain the methodology. He doesn't really... Well, the last paragraph in 37. See, he does have questions about the legitimacy of this. He says it is evident that the distinction of modern times between what it meant and what it means, that is, theological interpretation, which is normative, is problematical in both its distinction and its task. Hassell's not endorsing this. He says it's problematical. Then he says, Child says, critique this. That's at the bottom of page 38. He's critiqued it, that goes on over 39. And similar points made by others. And then you see, towards the bottom of 40, he says, is it not possible for biblical theology to have normative value on the basis of its recognition that it is done within the biblical context, first of all, and that the Bible is normative in itself? Top of 41, would it not be one of the tasks of biblical theology to come to grips with the nature of the biblical texts as aiming beyond themselves, as ontological and theological in their intention and function through the ages, without defining in advance the nature of biblical reality? But then he says this will emerge more clearly if we survey other approaches. I think his real critique of this doesn't come through clear here. But later in this book, he critiques very strongly the historical critical method. And when it comes to his own proposal for doing Old Testament theology, he tries to avoid this dichotomy of what it meant, what it means as well. Yeah.
I just have two questions. The first one is a clarification on that last paragraph.
Yeah.
Page 41, top. Mm-hmm. I'm not even sure I understand what he's saying. It says the nature of the biblical text is only beyond itself is ontological.
I'm not sure what that means either.
Oh.
Yeah. Well, I would think what he'd say, I'm just speculating here, but the nature of biblical texts aiming beyond themselves is ontological and theological in their intention and function through the ages. I think what he's saying is that the biblical text is placed on them from outside depending upon what faith community may be looking at them, you see. It's something that is inherent in the text itself. That's probably what he's getting at. Which seems quite a different idea than this, what it meant, what it means then.
In light of that, it says their intention and function to the nation. I don't know, I may title them out of the question.
All right.
As conservatives, when we execute the scriptures, where do we maintain the distinction between our time period and reconstruct or understand the time? We do try to understand the historical, geographic, cultural, linguistic context in which the deal with what their reasons are.
Yeah.
And what these guys are trying to do, which is basically, of course, in the end, it seems to be a tangible reconstruction in many cases. But there seems to be, in both camps, an attempt to do similar things.
I'd say the difference is the use of method in going about that. What you say that we would do, certainly something I would agree with, we use grammatical, historical, theological exegesis to determine what was the intent of the writer when he composed these words, and what is the meaning that best we can understand, what is the meaning he intended us to receive from that. That's what exegesis is all about. See, what Stendhal would do would say, not only use grammatical, historical, theological exegesis, use the historical critical method as well, which is going to radically alter the nature of these texts, because when you read a text that has the miraculous or divine interventions or whatever, or you look at a text that represents itself as coming from Moses, the historical critical method is going to say, well, that didn't really come from Moses, it came from somebody living in the exile. So that then you see the significance or meaning of that's put in a totally different context, which affects its significance. So I'd say that use of historical critical method is the primary point of difference between what he's proposing to do and what he would do.
So that's the starting point.
Oh, yes.
But if it wasn't, if they started with a more genuine exegetical approach, then it would kind of,
the problem with the historical critical method. The historical critical method involves assumptions that are completely incompatible with the nature of the material we're trying to deal with. So,
They would say that when Paul quoted Old Testament scripture, and let's say the book of Romans, and developed a theology around his interpretation of those quotes, or what he saw that those quotes meant, and what they mean theologically, they would say that meaning is no longer, that meaning is not inspired by God, right? That's not normative for Stendhal. That they're, what I reconstruct is now normative. So inspiration is really has no significance at all.
I think he would say that because he says, in essence, that it was equally valid for the Jews to go the way they went with reading the Old Testament, or for the first century Christians to go the way they went. The only difference is this element of faith. The one believed that led one way, the other believed it led the other way. Now, I would think he would still have to make some sort of distinction between what Paul does and what people subsequent to Paul did, given that Paul was one of the apostles and, subsequent communities of belief don't share in that apostolic character. But I'm not sure how he'd make that distinction. Maybe he wouldn't.
No room for inspiration. What you're saying sounds like there's a door open for inspiration. In his view, then he would allow somehow the scholar authority to theology in some way.
Well, that's what I said. I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure whether it would or it wouldn't. It seemed to me you'd have to make some distinction between apostolic viewpoint and that of subsequent periods in Christian history, but I'm not sure if he does. I'm not sure.
The door anyway is open to go the other way, as far as somebody wanted to take it literally.
All right, let's go ahead. I just have some, for the most part here, some rather sketchy comments. You've done this assignment, most of you, something similar to this, for these nine methods. First one, dogmatic didactic method. I think that's quite clear. Some of these are not as clear as others, as far as what is meant by the method. But dogmatic didactic method of organizing Old Testament theology is borrowed from dogmatic or systematic theology. Example, God-man salvation scheme. Strongest case for this method was made by R.C. Denton. Others include Cordero and Hinson. Problems. Old Testament patterns of thought are not structured along lines of theology, anthropology, soteriology. The center of the Old Testament does not become an issue because the center is determined by the scheme. It is theology, anthropology, soteriology. So you see that approach, dogmatic didactic, is to bring the categories of systematic theology to bear on the content of the Old Testament, and then to organize the content of the Old Testament under headings that are familiar to you from systematic theology. J. Barton Payne does a lot of that in his theology of the Old Testament, where he'll have the Old Testament doctrine of sin, the Old Testament doctrine of atonement, or you know, whatever. Theological categories under which he organizes Old Testament content. I don't know, I'd have to look back at that. I'm not sure I can respond to that.
I like both.
Yeah, I think, to me, Payne's moves too much in this direction. Now, maybe he's trying to combine the two in some way. Two, genetic progressive method. This is more where Voss is. Definition from Chester K. Lehman. The method of biblical theology is determined in main by the principle of historic progression. The unfolding of God's revelation as the Bible presents it. Note the influence of Voss and Olin, who both do that. Two, Lehman's use of one, Pentateuch, former and latter prophets, three writings is not strictly representative of historical progression. This is Hassel's comment, you know, by way of a critique of that, especially with the writings, it's not strictly representative of historical progression. And three, R.E. Clemens ignores wisdom literature completely. The canon for Clemens is, in effect, the wall and the prophets. Wisdom literature, you see, is the writings have always been a problem in this scheme of things. It's exactly how you fit them in. The law and the prophets fit pretty well together, but then how do you organize the wisdom material in this scheme of things? You see one of the difficulties of that method. All right, third, the cross-section method. I have a little bit more extensive comment here. The most prominent representative is Walter Eichroth, Theology of the Old Testament, 2 volumes, see bibliography. Also, Expository Times Review by Gottwald. Remember I mentioned in Expository Times there were a series of reviews of various Old Testament theologies, and Gottwald reviews Eichroth. As we already noted in his article of 1929, Eichroth rejected Eisfeld's division of biblical study into distinct and separate disciplines. One historical, objective scientific. The other theological, subjective and confessional. His claim was that there is a subjective element in every science, and even though this is also true of the theologian, this does not justify the claim that Old Testament theology is unscientific in character. So he tries to overcome that dichotomy. In Eichroth's view, this is taken, some of this is taken from Hans,
assessment of, I quote, in the Old Testament Modern Research, page 233. In Eichler's view, the function of the historical method was to provide the factual data regarding the development of Old Testament religion. The function of theology was to explain the permanently significant ideas that appeared in the religion. This selection of the constants can be said to provide the backbone of the Old Testament. Thus, Eichroth suggested that the Old Testament scholar as historian trace the stages in the growth of religious ideas, and as theologian, make a cross-section through the historical process to bring out the interrelationships between the basic notions that constituted the essence of Old Testament religion. He urged that in Old Testament theology, the historical principle should operate side by side with the systematic in a complementary role. Old Testament Theology, page 32, where he's discussing the problem and the method. He said it was, quote, high time that the tyranny of historicism in Old Testament studies was broken and the proper approach to our task rediscovered, end of quote. He goes on to say, this is no new problem, certainly, but it is one that needs to be solved anew in every epoch of knowledge, the problem of how to understand the realm of Old Testament belief and its structural unity, and how, by examining on the one hand its religious environment and on the other its essential coherence with the New Testament, to illuminate its profoundest meaning. Only so shall we succeed in winning back for Old Testament studies in general, and Old Testament theology in particular, that place in Christian theology which at present has been surrendered to comparative study of religions. Eichroth 1, Bayes, page 180. Eichroth chose as his organizing principle the idea of covenant. Contrary to those who viewed covenant as a late idea in the development of Hebrew religion, Eichroth said it was Moses, quote, who had originated the idea when he founded the religion on a covenant between God and the people. On 234. Eichroth warned against any, quote, arrangement of the whole body of material in Old Testament theology which derives from some dogmatic scheme, such as theology, anthropology, soteriology. Instead, one should follow the lines drawn in the Old Testament itself. This, Eichroth says, speaks of a revelation of the God of the people, who in his rule proves himself to be also the God of the world, and the God of the individual. We are therefore presented with three principal categories within which to study the special nature of the Israelite faith in God. God in the people, God in the world, God in man. So that is some idea of what's meant by cross-section method. Hassell has some reservations. He comments, page 53, his systematic cross-section test treatment is so executed as to exhibit the development of thought and institution within his system. The cross-section method, with Eichroth's use of the covenant concept as the means whereby unity is achieved, is to some extent artificial, since the Old Testament is less amenable to systematization than Eichroth suggests. Now, that's a theme you're going to find pretty regularly with Hassell. He doesn't really feel you can organize the Old Testament in any kind of, under any kind of unifying theme. And Eichroth attempts to do that with the covenant idea. And Hassell's skeptical that that can really be done. Elsewhere, Hassell says, is it not impossible to do justice to the multiform and multiplex nature of the biblical witness in attempting to grasp the richness of the biblical testimonies by a unilinear approach determined by one single concept, whether it be covenant, election, kingdom of God, rulership of God, communion, or something else. Now that statement, I don't have that documented there, but that comes from the first edition of his book, page 46, not the first edition. The editions of this book are confusing. That comes from the revised edition, which is really the second edition. The one we're working with is the revised and expanded third edition. But in the revised edition, page 46 is where that other statement is. But that
he doesn't phrase that exactly the same way in his third edition. Other examples of this method. T.H.C. Friesen combines the cross-section method with a squarely confessional interest. He claims Old Testament theology, by virtue of its object and method, must be a Christian theological science. His organizing principle is communion. Walter Kaiser uses promise as an organizing principle. Hassel has reservations regarding his success. We'll discuss that later. We're going to look at Kaiser in more detail. I guess we better take a break. It's 8 minutes up. Take a 10-minute break.